have evolved in medium as well as in purpose, from murals and clay tablets to today's GPS and smartphones. But for most of history, paper maps were the norm, and as they went from navigational tools to works of art, an industry of map dealers emerged. Michael Blanding looks at this history and a man who exploited it in his latest book, The Map Thief. Mr. Blanding is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. His book is published by Gotham Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You focus on the history of map making starting in 2300 BC and move right on to Ptolemy in the second century. He really did make an important contribution to cartography.
Yeah, Ptolemy was one of the original map makers way back in Alexandria during ancient Egypt. And he actually mapped much of the world centuries before the Middle Ages or the Age of Exploration or any of that. And those maps were later rediscovered and helped actually spur the Renaissance and the discovery of North America.
Because Columbus used them 1,300 years later?
Absolutely, yeah.
Did they suggest that the world was flat, or did Ptolemy already think the world was round?
They were pretty well convinced that the world was flat. It was round at that point. That wasn't into question. But what was interesting was that Ptolemy actually shrunk the size of the Earth down. He actually miscalculated the size of the Earth, and so it looked like it was much easier to sail across the Atlantic Ocean than it actually was. And if not for that, then Columbus might have thought twice about heading west.
But another Greek did kind of estimate the size of the world and decided that it was round. I think his name was Hero, that was just ignored.
Yeah, exactly. His calculations somehow ended up in the dustbin, and Ptolemy's came out on top.
You call the 15th and 16th centuries in Europe the golden age of map making. Is that because of the discovery of the New World?
Yeah, it happened right along the same time, and it was really the Dutch that spurred that golden age of cartography. And originally, they were going around Africa and going to the Spice Islands in the east, and it turned out whoever had the best maps could get there faster and make more money, and really spur this amazing age of maps, not only being tools for exploration, but also just beautiful works of art themselves.
When was the first map that used the term America made?
That was in 1507. This mapmaker by the name Martin Waldesmuller was a German mapmaker, and he named it after Amerigo Vespucci, who was circulating a pamphlet at the time that had all kinds of lurid details about the inhabitants of the Americas. And so it was a very popular pamphlet, and he named it after Amerigo Vespucci rather than Columbus. Yeah, exactly.
Otherwise, we'd be living in Colombia.
Colombia,
right,
yes. And he later thought better about that, and in later maps, he took the word America off, but it was already become so popular at that point that the word stuck.
And that map in 1507... was bought by the United States government for $10 million?
$10 million, yeah, the most expensive map ever sold. It's in the Library of Congress now. It's, they call it the Birth Certificate of America, and it's behind glass at the Library of Congress.
Gerard Mercator published his world map with the Mercator projection in 1569. That's pretty early. How did that change global navigation?
Well, the Mercator projection was quite a revolution at the time because it allowed sailors to chart a long distance in a straight line. Before that, they were always having trouble with the circular shape of the world, that it could work well for short distances, but once you tried to go, say, across the Atlantic, you couldn't hold that straight course. And so by elongating the lines of longitude, he was able to create that map and, of course, create the distortions that we're familiar with today.
Well, the distortions gave more importance to the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere.
Exactly.
Kind of a Eurocentric view of the world.
Right, yeah, and so that's the map that we all grew up with in school and remember hanging on the wall, and that's the image that we created, and it really shows how maps influence the way that we view the world and the stories that they tell that maybe aren't so apparent until you start investigating them.
Because it diminishes the importance or the size of Africa and South America.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just by what you choose to put on a map or how you choose to draw the borders, you know, you can tell different stories about maps, and sometimes there's sort of ancillary stories that that get created that you weren't even intending.
How long did those images last? Is it a fairly recent development that we've gotten our maps a bit more accurate? Unless we're Apple.
Well, I think even in the age of Google Maps and satellites, that you still have to make choices about what you put on a map and where you draw the boundaries. And you look at, for example, maps of Crimea that Russia was drawing maps one way, and the Ukraine was drawing maps the other way, and depending on where they put that border, they were really using them to say something different. So I think it continues to this day.
It's fascinating to look at an old map and see where national borders were. Even fairly recently, the breakup of Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, now Crimea suddenly being part of Russia. The atlas was created right after Mercator came up with this map. Is that an important development?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The first atlas was created by a mapmaker named Ortelius. And before then, these Dutch navigators that were trying to reach the Spice Islands, they had to sort of cobble together, maps from various different sources. And he was the first to kind of put them all together in one book and create this beautiful volume that continued.
Talking about the Dutch, one of the greatest painters ever is Vermeer. And he did paintings where the walls were decorated with maps. Was that common in the Netherlands at the time?
It really was, because, as I said, maps became almost works of art, and they were used to tell the Dutch people. They were a source of pride about how well they'd mapped the world and how much of it they'd discovered, and it was a symbol of national pride and wealth. And so people started hanging on their walls as art objects and not using them for navigation, and that was really sort of the start of what made a lot of these antiquarian maps valuable even today.
And that... It leads to the title of your book, The Map Thief, the gripping story of an esteemed rare map dealer who made millions stealing priceless maps. Why did the business of map dealing start flourishing in the 1980s?
Yeah, it was interesting. Up until then, maps were not worth a whole lot. There were bookstores that used to use old maps for wrapping paper to send books to rare book collectors. And right around the 1980s, they became very popular in home decorating for people who couldn't afford to buy a Monet or a Pizarro, but they could afford a Mercator or an Ortelius map to hang on their wall.
And so it's a step up from the bullfighting poster, but a step down from the Monet.
Exactly. Yeah. So they just started going up and up in value, and map dealers began selling them for thousands and tens of thousands of dollars at that point.
The title character of your book is a map dealer with a wonderful name, E. Forbes Smiley III. Did he have a specialty?
That's a name you just like couldn't make up. I mean, it's just so perfect to think of a rare map dealer. And he really specialized in the highest value maps. He looked at maps of primarily of the discovery of North America between 1500 and 1800, and really dealt with the cream of the crop, the best of the best, upwards of $100,000, some of them.
Well, he did take advantage of this growing business. He was able to write out an IOU and go home with a $50,000 map?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually incredible. Even today, a lot of the map business is a handshake business. I was able to buy a map. Of course, I only spent $500 on the map that I bought at the Miami Map Fair, but I walked right out with an IOU, and it's just kind of the way that it's done. It's really a business that's done on trust, and it was ultimately that trust that he ended up exploiting.
What happened when he didn't pay for the map? Did people sue?
Some people stopped doing business with him. He started getting a reputation for being for bouncing checks or being slow to pay or not paying at all. But many people continued to do business with him for 20 years until eventually it was revealed that he was actually stealing maps on the side.
That's something that came a little later, wasn't it? Who was he stealing from?
He stole from six different libraries across the country: the New York Public Library, Harvard, Yale, Boston Public Library, the Newbery in Chicago, and the British Library in London.
How do you walk out of a library with a map under your arm, a large map? It's hard enough to sneak out with a book.
Yeah, it was surprisingly easy for him that he would, a lot of these maps were in these old books that weren't very well cataloged. Sometimes the libraries wouldn't even know the map was there. And he would just wait until someone's back was turned, and he would rip it out and fold it up and put it in his blazer pocket and walk out with $50,000 in his pocket.
How is the value of a rare map determined? Who's appraising them?
It's mostly determined by the market itself, you know, basically what people are willing to pay for them. And some of these maps, you know, there might be a dozen copies of them in the world, and a particular region may get more enticing to people, and people bid against each other at auction and drive up that price.
The most expensive map he stole was the city plan for Boston by John Bonner from 1722. It was worth $185,000. You would think that its owner would have been a little more careful for something that valuable.
Yeah, it's surprising sometimes. But, you know, maps aren't like works of art where there's one painting and it's hanging in a museum and everyone knows where it is. You know, it was always possible that there was another copy of one of these maps floating around someplace. And because he'd been a legitimate dealer for so long, people believed him when he said that that he found it. But yeah, some of them were incredibly rare and only came up on the market once a generation. So there is the argument that people potentially could have been more careful.
And Smiley put it in a catalog that was mailed to the library he'd stolen it from.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
They didn't notice?
Yes. One of my favorite stories in the book is a map that he stole from Yale. He ended up selling to a map collector up in Maine. And there was a cartographic conference in Maine, and the collector had a specially commissioned beer bottle from Shipyard Brewery and ended up putting the map on the beer bottle at this cartographic conference. And there were only, you know, a handful of copies of this map in the world. And you had map dealers and collectors from all over the world sipping beer with basically a picture of a stolen map on it. And no one was any the wiser that was actually stolen.
And it's because there are sometimes more than one that people don't notice that it's theirs that they're being offered?
That's right. Yeah. You know, it's not like these maps have, you know, serial numbers or anything. Sometimes they would have library stamps that, and Smiley went to great lengths to obscure them. So he would cut off the stamps or rub them out. Some maps he'd actually paint or he'd bleach the paper, you know, anything to make it so that people didn't realize where they had come from originally.
How was he finally caught?
It was actually an interesting story. He was at the Yale University Library and ended up dropping a razor blade on the floor. He had a cold that day, and it was wrapped in a tissue, and went to blow his nose and dropped the razor blade on the floor and didn't realize it. And a really attentive librarian saw it when he was out to lunch, and they started doing research on him and realizing he was a map collector, and alarm bells started going off, and so they followed him out, and they found some maps on his person.
The librarian immediately identified four of the eight maps that he was carrying. Then they had to start figuring out how many maps he'd stolen over the years. Do we know for sure how many?
Yeah, it was a real detective hunt. You know, this one FBI agent who was, you know, before this he was more versed in investigating violent crimes, and now he's going and trying to actually, you know, match up these maps to libraries. And Smiley did eventually end up cooperating. He admitted to stealing 97 maps, but I was able to find almost a dozen maps that he hadn't admitted to that he stole, and the libraries accused him of stealing upwards of 100 more. So the truth probably lies in somewhere in the middle, and we may never know the answer.
Were the libraries able to get their maps back?
The ones that he admitted, most of those were actually returned to the libraries eventually, and I was able to go and view many of them today. You can walk right in off the street and you can see many of them.
Did the people who'd bought the maps from him have to just give up the maps? Did they suffer financially?
It was actually the dealers who were left kind of holding the bag at the end of the day. They got their maps back from, Smiley would sell them often to other dealers who'd then sell them to collectors. And so these dealers would buy the maps back from the collectors and give them back to the libraries. But some of them were out hundreds of thousands of dollars. Three dealers in particular that Smiley did a lot of business with were significantly harmed.
Smiley wasn't the only person to be caught stealing from prestigious libraries and museums. Has this led to them being a little more careful? Have they been putting together comprehensive inventories of their rare maps?
Yes and no. There's some things that they absolutely have done to increase security, increase cameras in the reading rooms, digitize maps so that if they are taken, they can identify them properly. But there's this overriding issue that these things are meant to be seen, and they want to provide access to scholars. And if you want to do that, you can't ever, lock them up and throw away the key. So there's always going to be access, and there's always the potential that theft could reoccur.
Did Smiley serve time for what he'd done?
He did.
And then you interviewed him.
I did, yes. He served 3 years in prison, which was surprising to many, considering that he stole over $3 million worth of rare maps.
Didn't he argue that the maps weren't being viewed in the libraries and that he was just putting them back in the world? He was doing a service?
He did justify that at a certain point after his trial. I think that he's since felt remorse about that. When I interviewed him, I actually found him to be very remorseful and had really regretted a lot of the librarians and dealers that he'd befriended over the years, the way that he betrayed them. But he's out of jail now and living on Martha's Vineyard, and I was actually the first journalist to get a chance to interview him.
I would have thought by now we have a pretty good idea of how maps work. And then there was the embarrassment that Apple went through when it came up with its alternative to Google Maps. So are maps still evolving today?
I think so, and I think
We haven't settled on a standard?
Well, once you take a geography and kind of shrink it down to usable form, you think of like the incredible amount of detail out in the world, and then you shrink it down to the size of a piece of paper or in case of Apple, it's a screen on a smartphone. You've really got to make a lot of decisions about how you represent that world. And I think today with GPS and everything, it's a very different type of representation of the world with us at the center with that blinking cursor than to have, an antiquarian map that you can lay out on a table. So I think we are still evolving in the way that we're depicting the world on maps.
And anyone who has used GPS knows that sometimes GPS will tell you to make a left turn when you can't make a left turn.
Right.
There's no street there, or there's a street running underneath the bridge that
right.
you're traveling over. So we still have a long way to go, I think.
And I think that's the danger. I think we've gotten too dependent on our GPS, and we just kind of blindly follow that arrow until it leads us on a wrong turn. And, you think about a paper map, it's just a very different way of viewing the world, and you can see how all the streets are put together for yourself.
Our previous book was about Coca-Cola, and now we have maps. The Map Thief, the gripping story of an esteemed rare map dealer who made millions stealing priceless maps. It is published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being on our show, Michael Blandon.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.